Hello and welcome back to the Future Work Life podcast. My name is Ollie Henderson and I've got another great guest for you today. Hannah Grady Williams is the founder of The Skills. As you'll hear, she's helping teens stand out by graduating high school with more experience and connections than most college grads. And her business is a really amazing reflection of what can be done using technology to enable people of any age to learn the skills which are going to serve them well in the modern workplace. Hannah and I talk about why she started The Skills and specifically the problem which it's looking to solve, which relates to mainstream education. We also talk briefly about Hannah's previous job, which was advising companies about how to get the best out of Gen Z. And we touch on some of the brilliant sprinters, the young people who are taking part in the Skills program and learning how to apply AI and other new technology to solving real life business problems for companies. So thanks as ever for listening. If you want to find out more about Hannah and The Skills, there are of course links in the show notes. If you'd be interested in talking to me about some of the themes we discussed today, you can get in touch with me as always through another link in the show notes. So let's jump into my conversation with Hannah. Hannah, pleasure to have you on the show today. What is wrong with education as it currently stands?
Wow, you were right about the surprise of this question, Holly. So many things. I believe the fundamental problem of traditional education is that it prepares students for tests, not for life. And especially with the fast-changing world that we're in, and you know, as we're going to talk about, the world that's powered by AI and, you know, in today's present and future, our education system is not just preventing kids from gaining access to tools, skills, and mindsets that they'll need for their future. It's actively handcuffing them from actually untapping and unlocking these things inside of humans that are actually going to make them still relevant in the future. Yeah. And I have a moral problem with that.
So I'm sure we can pick apart in more detail why this approach is fundamentally wrong. We can also explore some of the opportunities which these new technologies are creating in order to improve the situation. But let's just acknowledge perhaps why education systems currently do it in the way that they do. What insight have you gathered through your work so far that suggests there is some reason for it being like it is? Why is the system designed as it is right now?
So about 125 years ago, just crazy to think it's been that long, there were a group of men who came together and basically asked the question, how do we prepare our workforce or these, you know, future generations to be really great and efficient factory workers? That was the whole idea, right? Mm-hmm. So they took what school used to be, right, where you were in a single classroom, often with multiple grades, multiple styles of learning, and you sort of had the subjects combined in a sense. They took that and they went over to Europe. So I'm in the U.S., but they took this philosophy from, you know, understanding what was working in different parts of Europe, and they basically came back, at least for the U.S. education system, came back and said, we need to segment subjects. We need to have a bell that rings in between classes so people know class periods are over so that they're ready to go into factories where they're running their day by the bell. They're running their day by, you know, having this segmented knowledge or segmenting their tasks. You know, one guy had to work at this part of the factory line, another at that part. That was why the education system was designed the way it is. And in fact, there's a wonderful, wonderful documentary called Most Likely to Succeed. And we'll probably touch on it a few times. One of my investors, Ted Dintersmith, was the producer of this documentary, and he did it with Greg Whiteley. It's an amazing film, but they basically explore that whole history of what happened. Why do we segment, you know, science from math, from reading, from writing? And it's all messed up when you look at it the context of school from the modern lens, where we're shifting quickly, you know, quicker and quicker toward a world where even knowledge working is becoming outdated. We're moving into a creator capitalist era where people need to know how to create value for their companies, for their own businesses. And that sadly is just not in part of pretty much any part of the school system, whether you look at the US or at UK, or we have students in Brussels and you know, parts of Belgium and France, and it's the same everywhere.
Yeah. And look, when you've got a huge numbers of kids in the school system and within schools, I guess the big challenge is personalizing the experience. It's pretty difficult. You know, it takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of money to actually be able to provide those resources in order to be able to do it. So might we just be getting towards a point where we do have the standard school system, which is perhaps providing like a baseline of education, and we have to create this essentially simultaneous experience for kids where they get to personalize the learning experience, where they do get to leverage skills in a different way, maybe understand where their personalities and their natural inclinations towards certain types of learning experiences mean that they can create their own path? I mean, is it realistic to think that schools can actually create that personalized experience, or does it just inherently demand that we create other systems to support this new experience?
Gosh, this is such a good question. I'll answer it in two ways. So the first way is, when I first started DeSkills, and I'm, you know, 25, and we can go into all that jazz, but I'm just, you know, a few years past high school and college. And when I first started DeSkills and met Ted Dindersmith and Christopher Lockhead, who is, you know, our mutual friend and who we both know, I approached them with this conversation, this idea of, okay, Ted, you've been doing work for decades inside the school system with practically unlimited resources. So Ted had a long career in venture capital. He was one of the top venture capitalists of the 90s. He was one of the first investors in Twitter. You know, he basically then pivoted his whole career to focus on changing education from the inside. And that change is just not happening quickly enough. You know, school is still segmenting subjects. It's still wrenching out the creativity and the tenacity and all of that from our kids. So when he and I first started talking about this idea, we realized that, you know, approaching the problem from trying to fix the education system was simply not going to work, especially with AI moving this quickly. So we wanted to create a solution from the outside, you know, something that, to your point, students could do in parallel with a typical education so that they're not missing out on the experience and the skills they're actually going to need for their future. So that's segment number one. Is I think, to your point, that's a really smart approach, is saying, you know, our kids are going to be in this education system whether we like it or not. So what can we do to help them still, you know, gain those skills they need? The second way I'll answer this is, there are pockets of bright spots, and there are schools doing what I think is just incredible work with helping kids gain skills and mindsets. So, you know, if you're in a situation as a parent where you can afford to send your kids to one of these private schools, so there's several of these. There's Future of Education. There's Sora Schools. My friend Garrett Smiley runs Sora Schools. They're a private online school. There are pockets like in Most Likely to Succeed, in the documentary that I talked about, there's a school called High Tech High, and it's actually a public charter school, but they have students chosen by lottery. So it's in California. It's, you know, it's basically a draw of a straw if you're actually going to get your kid to go there. So, but they're doing things so right. I mean, just to give you a couple examples, they have, instead of grades, they actually have no grades. They don't segment their subjects. And their kids' performance is essentially determined by an end of semester showcase, where kids are exhibiting major pieces of work that involve everything from engineering to science to history to reading and writing. They're just, I won't spoil it all for the document if you want to watch this documentary, but it is absolutely phenomenal what these kids are creating in very, you know, short semesters. So there are pockets of bright spots, and that excites me. But for the majority of students, I'd say, you know, option one is far more realistic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the prevalent experience for most kids, and it is a big challenge. I experienced the same challenge for my own children, who are in mainstream education, and We're lucky probably that at least their school does encourage individuality and thinking differently, which I'd say are just two prerequisites, I think, when you're trying to bring your kids up to think about their place in the world, embracing being different and having individuality of thought. Look, you know, loads of questions about skills and kind of the idea behind it. And I suppose where it might lead, because I know it's relatively early stages and you've seen some really fascinating case studies. I was just skimming through your site as well, by the way, and I absolutely love the way some of the skills students are describing their expertise. It's just so cool. And there's young people just talking about confidently about the value they can bring, and that's just really cool. So anyway, I'm going to come back to that, but I just want to quickly rewind in time, not that far, but you've spent a few years advising businesses about Gen Z, and I suppose implicit in that must be that Gen Z think differently about their work experience. Now, I'm interested in whether that is fundamentally true, as in this generation of people are just different to the older generations in a greater degree than other generations are different from one another. But I also just interested to hear what's the same and whether it's actually just this sort of perpetuation of the system, which is means that there are experience is having to be different, and the economy and their ability to buy property and all these things which just seem so out of reach. Is that the thing that's different, or is there just a different mindset for this group of people who we categorize as Gen Z? What's the story?
So I actually, you'll never hear this from another person who's been in generational consulting, Ollie. This will be hopefully just brand new. I actually hate when people segment, you know, Gen Z from Gen Y from Gen X and create all these petty little fights between generations. I just hate that. I don't think it serves most of us. I think there's some, you know, interesting things we could glean from understanding, like you mentioned, the economic forces, the social forces that are shaping each generation. But this is what I did consulting on. And, you know, I helped organizations from startups to Fortune 500s working on their Gen Z recruiting and retention strategy. And this was, you know, I started in corporate when I was 17 and ended up pivoting out of corporate, starting my own company when I was 21. Anyway, been a lot of pivots. We can go down that road. But here is the fundamental different lens that we need to see Gen Z through. And every time I describe this, I have, you know, people share with me, I really have never seen generations through this lens, and it's helped me be a better manager or a better leader to Gen Z. So here's the lens. We all hear the term digital native or native digital getting thrown around about, you know, Gen Z or Gen Alpha, pretty much anyone under the age of 29-ish as of this year. But have you ever stopped to think about what native digital actually means? And here's what I mean by this. So I segment generations instead of by, you know, Gen Y, Gen X, all that jazz. I segment by two categories of human, native digital and native analog. And simply this means, what is your primary life experience? For most Gen Zers and Gen Alpha, you actually see something really interesting. It's that our native life experience is digital first, analog second. And for most people, you know, who's roughly upper Gen Y to Gen X to Boomer, of course, it's the opposite. So I'm curious if you see this in your kids. Like, have they, well, remind me how old they are.
11, 8, and 5.
Okay. Have they been introduced to digital, like, I don't know, watching YouTube, et cetera?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, we try our best, but I mean, it's impossible for them not to be, almost impossible.
Okay. I'm curious if you have this phenomenon happening in the UK, because we certainly do in the US. We have kids, you know, I'm the oldest of 7 kids. And my youngest sister is 9. Well, she suddenly one day, like a couple years ago, started speaking in a British accent.
Yeah. Well, my daughter speaks in an American accent. So.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. There we go. I asked her where she got that from. She's like, oh, Peppa Pig talks this way.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just a really, really superficial example. But we live in a global world now where kids are exposed to all sorts of cultures, every bit of, you know, whether it's social media or the shows they watch or YouTube or Reddit channels, whatever they're on, that's influencing how we think in a way that is at the, you know, the speed of light, unlike in previous generations. So you have a whole generation whose primary life experience is digital, and they actually see the physical world through the lens of the digital. You know, a kid who's into gaming will actually see things that happen in the physical world based on what they're used to from the digital world. And they might start using language or metaphors or imagery from the digital world to describe their analog experience. You know, and for my parents' generation, it was the exact opposite. They would, you know, they're savvy with technology, but it's an enhancement to the physical world or the analog world. So as you're thinking about like Gen Z and Gen Alpha and what it means to live in those generations, you have to fundamentally understand, if you're managing or leading Gen Z, that we're approaching life from that other lens, which makes it really difficult when you add the other implications like the economic factors, the social, whatever. If you understand that Gen Z is coming from this lens of digital first, well, let's take, you know, your example earlier of how difficult it is to buy a house. Well, if a Gen Zer has been watching their social feed, they're probably getting, if they're, you know, if they have any sort of real estate or entrepreneurial inclinations or whatever, they're probably getting fed dozens of hours a week of content about just how easy it is to buy a house if you just do blah, 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 you know, you just find leads. And so there's this sense of like, things are easy, but maybe the next video is, you know, some person complaining for ages and ages about how hard it is. So you're getting these conflicting messages really, really fast. And that's the pattern that your brain just goes into when you approach life. It's kind of confusing, Ollie, to be honest. And, you know, yeah. I'm at the upper end of Gen Z. Imagine, you know, your kids, and gosh, I can't imagine being a parent yet.
Yeah. All of which I think makes it even more important to help kids try to learn how to make better decisions based on the information they can receive. So in fact, on Chris's podcast, I can't remember who it was, but I had a great line from a professor who was on talking about knowledge as being a 20th century differentiator. Everybody's got every single fact, or fact, you could put fact in air quotes if you like, given there's often controversy around what's real and what's not. But let's assume that every bit of information you really want access to is available at your fingertips within seconds. So actually then it becomes about, how do you interpret that information? How do you utilize that information, cast judgment on it, and apply critical thinking, and then use that to make decisions? And I think that completely feeds into what we're going to talk about shortly, which is how you're getting kids to think about becoming young people with skills. That's the thing. It's this sort of transition from being a kid without a care in the world to be entering the workplace and building the skills to do it. So in a minute, we're going to step back to that, I guess, Gen Alpha. Where does Gen Alpha go to officially? Like, what age group are we dealing with right now?
So Gen Alpha starts around age 13, and it's anybody younger than age 13. So your kids are Gen Alpha.
Yeah, so they're not quite the cohort who are entering the skills. We're still in the sort of younger end of Gen Z. But before we just talk about that, those who are already in the workplace, you know, we are, as leaders of my generation, I'm a millennial just, but, you know, of our generation, who are thinking about how to give younger people just entering the workforce the support and systems they need to help them feel like they can grow their career. That has to be different as well, right? I mean, you know, that idea of a CV is just so outdated, right? You know, this idea that once every couple of years when we leave a job, we update our CV and try and remember what we've done and pick out a couple of highlights. And then that's this bit of this artifact, you know, this bit of paper in some cases, which you have to upload a Word doc or even, you know, even a LinkedIn profile. It seems mad, doesn't it, really, when like you see how dynamic the world is and the cadence with which we're, you know, everything's moving. And yet we don't provide
systems for people to be able to easily capture and reflect on the progress they're making and the skills they're acquiring. So, you know, just before we dig into the skills specifically, I mean, how do you think about that? You know, for particularly, you know, people, for example, of your age who typically have been in the workforce for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, what are they thinking about how they're building this skill set, how they're showing up in the world, how they're demonstrating their value and making themselves visible? And, you know, is there anything that you've seen work particularly well in actually amplifying that visibility?
Gosh, I think this is a major question that I've talked to so many of my, you know, the people I know in HR who are trying to find creative solutions to this. And, you know, if you think about, oh my gosh, what could a world look like where we had some way of measuring and hiring based on skills? You know, what if you could have, and we call them the skills, but I'll get into that in a second. It's a little bit different. You know, I think in the near future, we are going to see some company arise, and I'm excited about this. I hope, you know, I hope it's someone who's really got this vision right, so to speak. But this whole idea of a technology that could track people's skills, their you know, leadership ability, their soft skills, their hard skills, like everything, and store them in some sort of way. I was actually having this conversation with a friend of mine who's in Australia, who brought up the idea of, you know, could there be a way to assign not NFTs, but something similar to that, where you've got, you know, skills basically being tracked throughout your progress in your career, or your even being an entrepreneur, so that when you re-enter the workforce, if that comes up, or maybe you're a mom, you take time off to have kids, you come back, like some way to track that. And I don't know what the solution is. Maybe it'll be a Gen Zer who's like, we've got to figure out a way to do this. So I think that's like a pipe dream at this point. Maybe AI will help. I've seen some sort of fragmented approaches. Like there's a company called With You, With Me that's doing a great job of taking, you know, veterans who are trying to they're coming out of their service and they're migrating over to the workforce and finding ways to measure those skills and help them into the workforce. They're doing a great job with that. But again, it's fragmented. I'll answer your question, though, in a second way, which is at the skills, despite not having that tech, which if you hear of someone who comes on the show and they have that tech, like call me, because I would love to get students using it and, you know, sort of being the change makers and driving that. I don't know that it exists yet. But for our students, just thinking about the transition from school to their first job, we have a concept called impact portfolios, where, think of it this way. So most students are graduating from even college with very little real world experience, right? Maybe they were lucky and got an internship. But even for most college students, a lot of them are having to work their own way through college. Maybe they're working at, you know, McDonald's or Chick-fil-A or whatever to pay their way through school. And they end up graduating with a degree, but they really don't have real world context. And of course, that leads to all sorts of problems. Like maybe they actually hate the job they work, the field that they studied. I had a friend recently who graduated with a degree in health sciences, and she was supposed to go, you know, work in the healthcare administration side of hospitals, but she had never tried it. So she graduates with this degree. She's probably $100,000+ in debt. She graduates with this degree, starts this job and hates it, and ends up completely pivoting careers to something she didn't even need a degree for. So you have, I mean, that story is, I think, more common than uncommon. You know, you also have the age-old meme. I actually saw this morning, this age-old meme of like the project manager's plan versus the actual execution of the plan. You know, guys like leveling his espresso perfectly, you know, on his device, and then he dumps it to the side of a cup and it just pours all over the counter. You know, the idea of the plan versus execution. And that's what happens to kids all the time. They know how to build, you know, take business school. they know how to build these perfect business plans. But when it comes to executing them and all of the things you can't predict, like how humans are going to respond, you know, they're at a loss. It's easy to give up because they haven't been taught resilience at school. So there's just all these problems, whether it's going into debt, whether it's mental health, if you wanted to go, you know, deeper, whether it's just not having a grasp of how school and the real world connect. My goal as a leader and as a mentor to students is to help them erase as much of that disconnect as possible and help them actually build an impact portfolio that gives them a taste of real life and what will actually be needed in their careers, showing impacts they've made instead of just relying on textbooks or coursework. So, and we'll move on to this in a second, but the simplest way to define an impact portfolio is think of a resume, your typical, let's say, high school resume. What's going to be on it? Like maybe your part-time job at a retail store, you know, you got your Aeropostale hours on there. Maybe you've got your soccer leadership team experience. Maybe you've got, I don't know, an SAT score, your AP classes you've taken, right? Like that's a typical high school resume. That doesn't stand out. I mean, it just doesn't. Parents are dumping tens of thousands of dollars into college counseling or even, you know, counseling to help their kids get an internship based on resumes that look like that. It just doesn't cut it now. So you have the resume, but contrast that with the impact portfolio. So imagine instead you've got a student who, instead of graduating with a slightly better SAT score or more APs or a trip to, I don't know, Uganda to work at a hospital, imagine that instead of that kid graduating, you have a kid who has self-started impact projects where they identify small businesses in their community or they found on LinkedIn, and they approach those businesses and ask to make an impact using their digital skills. So that could be anything from building AI chatbots for small real estate companies to helping a, you know, a podcast like yours gain more visibility through digital marketing. Maybe, you know, a student has some really savvy web design skills or no-code web design skills. So they approach local florist shops and they design websites for them. And as a result, they're able to quantify the impact they've made. You know, maybe they increase website traffic by 10%. Maybe they you know, help a real estate agency generate 10 more leads per week because of this AI chatbot. Like, whatever that quantification is, imagine instead of a kid graduating with a good-looking SAT score, they have 5 or 10 of these impact projects on a portfolio showing how they've added real value, they've overcome real challenges, and they've actually impacted the real world with their digital savvy, which, of course, under that digital scope, you can read into the skills it's taken to get there, you know, pushing through when things get hard, being able to communicate, teamwork, right? So if you're a business owner or even at college and you're looking at someone with a resume versus someone with an impact portfolio, who are you going to hire? Like, who are you going to admit to your college? And every company I've worked with, and I've worked with about 3,000 now, every leader that I've worked with who have asked that question of will always say the impact portfolio. And I think that's really indicative of how, to go back to your original question, how Gen Z is, or at least how we're helping Gen Z think about the impact they're making that then launches them into their careers.
Nice. I like it. I think it's great. Yeah, no, look, and you're right, because absolutely some of the new skills they're learning, they're acquiring lots of new skills for them, but some of these new skills which just exist out in the world and in the workplace, anything related to generative AI is of course a new skill, right? And so it's useful that they're learning those because that puts them at an advantage against most people who are in the workforce already. But just as important, as you intimated there, are the skills they're building which just make them employable at some point. And before then, the sort of people that you want to invite into college And they are the communication skills, the ability to speak to people that you've never spoken to before, to understand their problem, to match that problem with a potential solution based on the skills that you're acquiring. And these are like the key skills in any business environment and in any team. And I like the fact that I think I'm right in saying this, certainly when I've heard you discuss this a couple of times, often they're paired up or put into a mini team essentially to work on a project. How does that work?
Yeah, a lot of times students in our sprints are, some of them like to work independently because ultimately they're getting the teamwork or collaboration from the business that they choose to work with. But more often than not, students will sprint with their friends. So I'll ask you this because this is always an interesting thought experiment. When's the last time that let's say someone under the age of 18 has approached you and said, hey, you know, Ollie, I noticed based on your website that you've got these impact gaps that I really think I could help solve. Like, I'm a local high school student in your area. I'd love to help you with these things. Here's some results from previous clients. When's the last time that happened for you?
And I feel like you know the answer to this. It's a rhetorical question. I've never been asked that. However, I tell you what, let me just tell you about one experience, which is not exactly the same, but it left an impact on me. So I was part of a group of podcasters who was invited to interview Stephen Kotler. I don't know if you know Stephen. He's also been on Chris's show. He is a peak performance expert. He runs an organization called the Flow Research Collective. Really interesting work. Anyway, I was on among this small group of podcasters, and there was two teenage podcasters on that. And they subsequently, I guess, probably contacted other people who are on the call as well, contacted me and said, we noticed you're on Stephen's call. Since then, we've had a look at your newsletter. We like the work that you're doing. They aligned with some of the stuff that they were talking about on their podcast. Would you come on the podcast? And I was like, well, yeah, of course, because, you know, why not? You know, and so I went on the podcast, and they've stayed in touch, and they've now gone off to college. They changed their podcast. I can't remember what it's called, sadly, but I'll try and remember by the end of the show. They changed the name of the podcast to something slightly different. But as far as I understand it, they're still working on it alongside their studies. And what they are effectively doing is building their impact portfolio because they're doing stuff that normal people don't do. That's the point. Most people don't do this. They don't go the extra mile. They don't put themselves out there. They don't get on to a podcast chat with a well-known author and then follow up with other people on the call. And you know what? I'm connected with them on LinkedIn. And if they came knocking at some point and said, we are now looking for work or we're doing some other project, I'd take them seriously straight away and that I'd answer their call. I suppose that's just an example where I haven't had the call you described, but I've had a similar experience and it does leave an impression.
Gosh, I love that. Yeah. And to your point, I mean, that if I heard you correctly, that one example stands out so much in your mind because no one does this.
Yeah.
No high schoolers do this. And high schoolers don't know that. Mm. You know, a high schooler doesn't realize a couple things. They don't realize they can use their age as an advantage. I had to have an older mentor tell me this when I was 19 and traveling around the world with, you know, doing training on behalf of another company on customer service and engagement. And this older mentor, Deb, who's now I just love her. She had the tenacity the first time we met to ask me how old I was and to push me and say, you know, Hannah, why are you trying to hide your age? You know, why I was pretending I was, you know, 26, 27, just so I would gain quote unquote respect from the people I was training who were much older than me. But she had the tenacity to say, don't hide your age. Use that as an advantage because you're going to stand out. And that was one experience that gave me the courage to now, as I get to mentor students, help them understand no one does this. No one reaches out. And number one, they don't have the ability to see an impact gap most of the time. You know, in high school, you're not taught to find impact gaps and find solutions for them. So the reason I bring this example up is if you're in a team, let's say it's you and a friend, and all you do for the 10 weeks of Impact 10, which is sort of the core engine of the sprint we're talking about, if all you did for 10 weeks was reach out to small businesses, you know, find impact gaps, reach out to them, put yourself out there and just say, hey, I saw this opportunity you've got with your social media, your website, your AI usage, whatever it is, whatever your interests are. If all you did was reach out to 100 businesses and get denied by all 100 of them, you've learned more than what most high schoolers get taught their entire time in school. That's my controversial belief.
Well, look, I was just about 2 hours ago, I was out for a run with another dad who lives locally, and we were talking about this. And he's a leadership and communication coach. And he was recently doing some training with a sales organization, you know, sales team within a big company. And it was ostensibly about being better storytellers. But afterwards, they said to him, that was the best sales training that I've ever had. And he's like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that's what we were doing. And I was describing my experience early in my career when I had a job for about a year where I basically just cold called people. I had to pick up the phone 100 times a day and I had to try and get through to people. And I only probably got through to 20 people, and some of them weren't very nice to me. They didn't say very nice things. And most of them told me they weren't interested, but there were a few who bought eventually. And do you know what? I was saying to him, as I'm starting a new company again now, that experience has completely shaped what I'm like now. I realized that people saying no to me isn't a reflection of my character. It's just that they either just not in the mood or don't have the time or don't probably most likely just didn't need what I was selling. But as I experienced having to do that job, what I saw was a couple of things. One, it takes persistence to do well and to succeed. And also listening and understanding people's problems is really key. So look, as I'm saying this, because there's a few things that people will learn if they do knock on the door of 100 businesses. One is they'll get better by the end of that of selling because they'll get a better understanding what the problem might be. But also they'll build that resilience, which you mentioned earlier on. But also, I'm absolutely convinced if you contacted 100 businesses and led with, I'm a 15-year-old, I've built this project, here's what I'm doing, at least 5 to 10 of those people would say, really? That's interesting. And you know what? I might not want the thing you're buying right now, but I might have something else that you'd be interested in doing for me because you've got something. And I think that's what I'd encourage people, again, like you, to think about is that putting yourself out there and just pushing yourself more than other people would do it is in and of itself a characteristic which people want to buy.
1,000%. I speaking of storytelling, I want to share this one story because we have so many amazing sprinters who are going from, you know, not really believing in themselves or believing that grades are the thing that defines them to by the end of just even 5 weeks into a 10-week sprint, telling us things like, I don't recognize who I was 5 weeks ago. Or things like, I may have been ghosted by multiple businesses, but I've now realized if I use my age, I can build a professional network at age 16. You know, like, and we have parents saying, I don't recognize my kid. You know, this is the type of excitement I always wished they had for learning. So we have one particular student who really stands out, and we're running a sprint right now. We're on week 9. The showcase is in just a couple of weeks where students get to talk about what they learned, what they built. And this one particular student, so her name is Priyal. She lives in Toronto, Canada. We have 3 goals for sprinters, and these are sort of the defined goals of the sprint, but obviously we've been sneaky and built in all of the competencies we want students to gain, even if they don't reach these goals. So the 3 things that our sprinters are setting goals for themselves to achieve is, number 1, having 50 LinkedIn connections by the time they leave a 10-week sprint. You know, these are professionals they've reached out to who they're interested in the career they've got. Maybe they are asking them to follow their journey as they leverage digital skills to make impacts, whatever it is, right? So 50 LinkedIn connections. The second thing is, by the end of the 10 weeks, we want students to have a paid impact project. So first they do an unpaid one to build their portfolio. Then they go pitch potential clients for a paid project. and we intentionally do not hand them these projects. They have to go find them, right? And then the third thing they leave with is all of the skills and mindsets necessary to essentially land more paying clients to continue building their skill set. Okay, so those are the three goals. But at the beginning of every sprint, a student, because the whole thing is gamified and student-led, so the students get to set their own goals. Priyal decided 50 LinkedIn connections is not tenacious enough for me. My goal is 200. That's what she said. She also said she wanted to make $400 to $500 on an impact project. And she said that her goal for herself was to do two different types of digital projects. You know, she didn't want to just build a portfolio based on logo design or graphic design and then have another paid project in that same realm. She wanted to do a couple different types of things, really challenge herself. So Priyal started with these audacious goals, but at the end of the day, she's your typical like average good student. She came to the first session, she showed us her calendar, just how packed it was with AP exams and, you know, all the things that her and her parents decided were the right thing for her to do. And she was just overwhelmed. I mean, she's just sitting there on the first call like, man, I'm so excited about this sprint, but at the end of the day, like, this is going to be a lot, you know? We get 3 weeks in, and I remember being on another live session, and she just comes so excited into this session. She's gone from like day one being overwhelmed to by week three standing out as a leader. So she actually points out two other sprinters to what we call, we're at the rebel base is what we call it. So she has two other rebels she pulls on her team and says, hey, join me in a breakout room. We're going to do this exercise together. She's facilitating the session basically in her own breakout room. She said in just 3 weeks, she had broken 100 connections on LinkedIn. She was working on, she had found a client, an ADHD coach on LinkedIn who needed help with course design. So she had basically approached this ADHD coach and had pitched to her, what if you could reach people who have similar qualities to ADHD but aren't diagnosed, and basically launch a creative learners course. And she went out and built this whole course. So by week five, she is like building this course. She's setting up, you know, payment plans for this coach to give her another stream of income. She's built AI agents to help her build more courses. And she is just on fire, just like, and she's telling myself and my co-host Shweta things like, I never thought learning could actually be fun. You know, I never thought that I had this possibility, but that business owner, the ADHD coach, her name is Christina, she emailed me last week and said, where did this person come from? This 17-year-old is more skilled than most of the professionals I've worked with at the, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 person companies that I've worked with. That's the power of like a student who says, I'm going to gain the skills. I'm going to like level up my own skills, build my own confidence, and then let my own self-doubt not be in the way of what I'm able to achieve. That is so powerful. Like Priyal is such an amazing example to me of what can happen when you let yourself, like you give yourself permission to fail.
She sounds like a star. This is awesome. I recognized her name and just brought LinkedIn up, and I recognize her name because she's LinkedIn with me. Like she connected with me on LinkedIn. So there you go. I'm just looking at her profile. I mean, you know, it looks stellar, it looks solid. Fair play to Priyal. Well, congratulations to you. We're running out of time, but before we do wrap up, is there anything else you want to leave us with?
Gosh, there's so many different things we could talk about, but
oh, we can do this another time as well. We can do this again in a few months, maybe just and hear about the next bunch of sprinters. I'll be fascinated to hear about them as well.
Yeah, no kidding. I'll just leave us with this. So I'm not a parent yet, but I'm the oldest of seven kids. And as I think about my parents and the life that they wanted to create for all of their kids, and how many challenges and opportunities they face as parents, and of course, millions of other parents face, what I keep hearing from parents and thinking about with my own is all we want for our kids is for them to have the confidence and independence to succeed in life, right? And I think about those goals. And I encourage just every parent, if you're, you know, if that's your goal for your student and you're thinking about the skills, the qualities, the characteristics you want your child to have, take a hard look at what school is providing them with and ask yourself, what other ways can I instill those qualities and those characteristics in kids? And not just thinking about it from the lens of, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, but from the lens of now. And the fact that we're now living in a world with AI, where AI is coming after, you know, the jobs that college graduates used to first enter into. It's coming after entry-level jobs, in especially white-collar ones, really, really fast. And I, you know, I make this very sort of controversial statement about what I believe will be the case in 3 to 5 years from now, where there's just going to be three buckets of careers. You have bucket number one, which is skilled trades, you know, our nurses, our plumbers, electricians, you know, the sort of hands-on jobs that we haven't figured out a way for robots to take yet. Then you have the second category, which is, I believe, encompasses all white-collar jobs, which is people who can leverage AI to create radical impact, drive revenue, and help businesses to succeed, slash use AI to create your own pathway. And then the third category is people who say, do you want fries with that? And I don't think anything but those three buckets exists anymore. You know, in the next 3 to 5 years, if AI is expected to grow at a rate of, you know, 8 to 10 times its ability every single year, that exponential increase in capability means that we as humans are going to have to be the most human versions of ourselves to stay relevant. So if you have a kid in middle school or high school and they're thinking about their future and you want them to develop confidence, independence, and tenacity, but if the school system is, number one, banning access to tools that help your kid gain a hand, a level up on gaining those skills and those competencies as fast as possible, which is what they're going to need, and they're also teaching kids the test and not what they need for life, then we have to, as like parents and mentors, ask, what are ways for my kids to gain these skills, these mindsets, in a way that's going to help them succeed in whatever the career world looks like when they get out of school? Because I'll be the first to say, I have no idea what it's going to look like. And it's, you know, it's projected that Gen Z will have on average 7 to 10 different careers in our lifetime. Not jobs, careers. That's how fast this is changing. So if kids are developing, you know, if they're not developing confidence, tenacity, the ability to rapidly change directions, like, what are we doing? I invite every parent who especially works in, you know, tech or in a company where you sort of see the writing on the wall happening, like you see this, oh my gosh, AI is here. It's here to stay. It's changing every way we work, think, and play. Then think about, what are the most fun, simplest ways to get kids involved with learning the things they'll need to be relevant and to be happy, fulfilled humans in the future? Because at the end of the day, that's what we all want for our kids. And it's the reason that I started DeSkills, because, oh my gosh, again, as an older sister, when I look at the world my siblings are growing up in, and my youngest sister, Nina, who's 9, and all of my siblings in between, just the confusion, the number of decisions they're having to make, the competition, like, all this is so, like, it can be really life draining. And I built DeSkills to be a place, like a community, where students are like excited again about possibility, about their own possibility, and about what they can do to help the real world. And so I like invite every parent, gosh, we've got so many just free resources. I'll send you some so you can link them in the show notes, but just free guides and workshops. And of course, my social content to help parents navigate this future for your kids and help your kids, you know, see other students who are paving the way for themselves and forging their own pathways and give them some hope. So if that's like hope giving to anybody, then gosh, I would love you to be a part of our community and, you know, come say hi on social, because this is something I feel, like I said at the beginning, I have a moral problem with what's happening, not just like a business problem. I have a moral problem with what's happening with our kids when they're not embracing these things. They're going to help them succeed. And I want to be that person for them.
Awesome. Hannah, thank you.
Thank you. This was a blast.
And that was my conversation with Hannah Grady Williams. Make sure you check out a link to her details and to DeSkills in the show notes. More great conversation next week. I'll see you here again then.